Well, we've got the international explorer, Jonathan Gray, with us, and we're going to take your calls with him when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Jonathan Gray. Jonathan, have you ever gone on a dinosaur bone dig?
No, but I know people who have. I have friends that have been. That's a very interesting occupation.
Sure is. That's got to be pretty fulfilling too, huh?
Oh, yes, very fulfilling. And another interesting thing about dinosaurs is that dinosaur blood has been found still to exist in dinosaur bones.
If you can find dinosaur blood, can't you clone it?
Well, I suppose that would be possible, yes.
Jurassic Park, here we go.
Mm.
That's fascinating. Is it a good career for somebody going to school right now to become an archaeologist?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's still plenty to be found. In fact, the consensus is that the discoveries in Egypt probably would still outnumber by 100 to 1 what we've already found under the desert sands.
And what about jobs? Where do they generally work? At the university level?
Yes, normally.
Okay, let's go take some calls here. We'll go to first-time caller, Richard in Los Angeles. You're up with us. Hey, Richard, go ahead.
Yes, hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Jonathan. I have a question for you. It was in regard to your mentioning Genesis and the debunking of evolution and these globalists not wanting that to be exposed. And what I'm wondering is, couldn't there be any divine intervention? Can God intervene in some way? Why do these people, why are they allowed to carry out this monstrous plan? What can we do?
Well, I think individually, that's a big subject and would require probably a whole broadcast. But what we can do is to share the news with others around us until it becomes such a worldwide knowledge that they'll have a hard job suppressing the people that they want to get rid of.
Yes, but how do you suggest
people
that
are waking
individual?
Up. Yeah, people are waking up, I'm glad to say. We just want everyone to wake up because it's going to be much harder for them to fulfill their agenda if they realize it's not going to be as easy as they thought they had made it.
Well, thank you for this program, and thank both of you. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. Tell me about cavemen and their paintings that go back thousands of years. What have you uncovered there?
Well, cave paintings are a very interesting subject. Down in the Kalahari Desert of Southwest Africa, there are cave paintings of men in elaborate garments, men with blonde beards, well-styled hair, and they wear boots, multicolored shirts, coats, gloves, boots. There's a woman wearing a short-sleeve pullover, closely fitting breeches and gloves and garters and slippers. How about that?
Okay, let's go to Phoenix, Arizona. Virgil, west of the Rockies. Hi, Virgil.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys doing this morning?
Great.
Great. I am so glad to be able to talk with you guys about this. This is awesome. Well, concerning the ancient knowledge and history and stuff like that, I have a story to tell you guys. See, I'm of Apache Navajo descent. My grandmother was a medicine woman out on the reservation, and she told me a story one night when I was a little kid about the stars, and that this story was passed down to her from her great-grandfather to from his great-grandfather, from his great-grandfather, in fact, generations. But the story goes is that out there in space, that it's dark, it's cold, there's no oxygen, that you wouldn't be able to breathe out there, and that if you were to take a rock and throw it, it would keep on going until it actually hits something.
That's pretty magical.
Yeah, and, well, it just kind of...
What's the physics behind that?
Well... Yeah, I mean, it kind of just got me thinking as a little kid because I'm a student of anthropology, and it got me thinking about where this knowledge came from, how they knew that there was no oxygen up there, and that the physics of them knowing that being no gravity, that things could keep on going until it hit something.
Okay, I stumbled across, by the way, Jonathan, an old movie of. You know, military troops, they were in Afghanistan. It was a movie now. And they stumbled across Vermana's flying machines.
Oh, wow, how intriguing.
Yeah, it was a great little movie. I mean, I got a kick out of watching that. Fascinating work. I mean, but where are they? Where are the devices, most of them? What happened to them?
Well, there's a computer in the Athens Museum. There's a skull with a bullet hole in it, a skull of an Egyptian mummy in the British Museum. Also the skull of an animal shot with some weapon that had the speed of a bullet in the Museum of Anthropology in Moscow. There are objects found in coal and in Precambrian in museums, private museums in the United States. They're scattered around a bit.
Okay, next up we go to Wilmington, Delaware. Robert, east of the Rockies. Robert, go ahead.
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good. It's a good day.
I've been fascinated with these caves myself. I'm seeing them on the internet. Are they searching these caves to see if they can find maybe dinosaurs or, you know?
Yeah, well, they go into these caves, Jonathan. What are they looking for?
Well, people do look for those sort of things, but more what they find is not too much except the empty tunnels, and unless they come to the remains of where people used to live in the cities. My friend who was kidnapped by that tribe in the Amazon,
yes,
he spent 4 months, I understand, there before they let him out. While there, they showed him something that I had actually written about in Dead Men's Secrets in my chapter on tunnels. And that was an ancient flying machine that was still preserved there by the people left behind.
Wow. Was it workable, do you know?
He sat in it, and during that time, he made very careful measurements, and he now has the specifications for this in his own possession. He's hoping to have somebody who can build a replica.
Did it have an engine, did he say?
No, he hasn't gone that far. He hasn't told me that much, but it had some means of propulsion. But going from my other research, there seems to have been several ways in which ancient aircraft could lift off. One was the use of mercury in flight. There's something about mercury that we don't use. The French actually tried to use it in a possible space program a few years ago. I'm not sure of the result of that, but mercury is one. Electromagnetism is another. These are methods we don't use. Well, we use, of course, gas, petrol, petroleum, and so on, which is a sledgehammer, a way to get off the ground and fly. I mean, that's trying to beat the laws of nature instead of work with them.
Tell me about these lights that went on and off from this tribe down in the tunnels.
Well, these lights actually were part of a technology that appears to have been worldwide. When the Spaniards came to South America, the conquistadors, they reported that a city at night could still be seen with its lights on.
Was it limestone, you think?
I'm not sure. They were on pillars about 20 feet tall. And they were big globes on top of the pillars, which shone with luminescence at night. In the daytime, of course, that wasn't obvious. But as the darkness came on, the light would get brighter and brighter and brighter and light up the old streets.
Okay, back to our wild card line now. We'll go to Leonard in Hinckley, Minnesota. There you go, Leonard. You're up.
Hi, George. Great show.
Hi. Yeah, he's doing a great job for us.
Yes. Jonathan, I got to say that everything you said tonight is just so, so interesting and enlightening. And my favorite thing you've told us is that, you know, the scientific proof for the Earth being created in such a short period of time. But my question is regarding the Sumerians and their snake, their deity being a snake. And when I learned about that, I was curious to know, is there any connection between the Sumerian deity and possibly the Hebrews and how Adam and Eve encountered a snake, maybe using it as an example of untrue knowledge in comparison?
Yes, there is quite a similarity. As a matter of fact, all nations had a legend of mankind being seduced by a being who took the form of a snake, and serpent worship became a worldwide phenomenon, still is in many parts of the world. That was the earthly counterpart of what later on became sun worship as well. The sun being the enlightener physically of the planet, they stated that the the serpent became the spiritual enlightener of the planet and led him away, man away from his creator, so that he could do his own thing. And that was the perversion of an original core of truth. Very interesting how all the nations took it on.
In Egypt, many of the structures, the statues, have that bird look to it, alligator head look to it. What do you think they were?
The bird symbol actually was another part of the same legend that the first woman saw with her eyes something that tempted her, and that the serpent was involved in the temptation. But the hawk then became a symbol of the woman because the hawk's eye. And this brought the bird's head into the symbolism of the gods and goddesses of the pagans.
Okay, we go next to Palos Verdes in California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Oh, hi, George. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
Fantastic. Hi. Incredibly relevant. I live in Palos Verdes Estates, and it kind of combines all the elements that you've been talking about tonight. This has one of the highest per capita incomes in the U.S., and it's kind of off the beaten track, and a lot of the top minds in aerospace live there. And anyway, it's a you know, the chemtrail, you know, the cross hatch is just centered over the community lot. And the last 5 years has been such incredible erosion. I mean, you can see it, you know, from the right angle. You can see hieroglyphics. You can see symbols, lettering, code, you know, in, you know, all over the cliff in different angles. You can see these elaborate face carvings. And I think there's, you know, there's ancient secrets because, you know, the archaeology there has been extensive and everyone, you know, super tight-lipped. You know, you can't find any information at all. And that's really incredible, the erosion in the last 5 years. I think they're using the chemtrails as, to foliate and defoliate areas they've either, you know, uncovered or, and want to cover back up. And another thing, the last 2 weeks, the ocean bottom there has just come loose. It's unbelievable. Just, I mean, giant boulders, I mean, tonnage and giant reefs have just come loose and been washing in, you know, just formed a whole different situation. And you have the, you know, kinds of military, you know, stuff. And they, the civilians and military, they have an elaborate system of communicating ship to probably, you know, craft in the sky, planes and probably satellites and whatever. And there's been a, in 2008, 2009, and now the last couple of months, there's been this frenzied activity, like convoys of cars just, you know, punching around, you know, just in a big,
something's
big hurry.
Going on. Yeah,
it's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, you can visibly see all the hieroglyphics in the cliff, and I think it has some, you know, navigational value and whatnot.
Have you heard, Jonathan, about ancient Egyptian artifacts found in the Grand Canyon?
Oh, yes. A Smithsonian explorer is reported to have discovered this cave way up high above the present river level. And well, what he actually found was also a dock for ships up there too. So the level of the canyon must have dropped rather quickly in just a few thousand years. But inside there were mummies and Egyptian hieroglyphics and apparently... according to the original report, artifacts were taken to the Smithsonian, but they deny having them now.
Jeez, amazing. What do you think of Noah's Ark? Where is it? Is it there? Is it up there on Mount Ararat?
I started out as quite a skeptic on that, George. I heard claims being made, and I took my own teams. We've been back there quite a number of times, and we have found the remains of a structure which is the same length as described in the book of Genesis.
Really? How high up?
About between 6,000 and 7,000, but not on Mount Ararat itself. It's to the south.
Okay.
Interestingly, the book of Genesis doesn't say Mount Ararat. It says the mountains of Ararat.
The mountains of. That's true.
Yeah. And Mount Ararat itself is apparently a post-flood volcanic mountain. It's only about 3,500 years old. It came up. It's come up in Turkish history.
Well, if this is tied into that calamity from 2345 BC, and then Noah got the inside scoop to start building the ark, then there must have been divine intervention.
He could not have known 120 years before and how he had to go about it unless there had been intervention. I believe you're right.
Bob in Miami, Florida, you're up with us. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, how you doing, George? Jonathan, how you doing?
Hi.
Hi. You guys were talking about Genesis. I'd like to add on to it.
Okay.
Okay. Jonathan, you said that the Earth cools really fast, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then George made a statement, said that the Earth was a gas planet at that time, right? Okay, now, what was it before it was a gas planet? I'm not done yet, George. Go ahead.
No, no, Jonathan, go ahead.
Well, what we go back to is a first cause. And there is no, according to the laws of cause and effect, which we know are confirmed, the effect cannot be greater than the cause. In other words, matter or gas could not form from non-matter and non-gas.
Okay.
So we go back to a first cause again, which is, who I guess we call that first cause God, the same one that created the earth and solidified it fast.
Okay, now... Now, I'm going to read from Genesis, from the Old and the Testament. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and this is my point, the earth was without form.
See, but now, to me, something gaseous would be without form.
Yes, exactly, I agree with you.
A gas cloud, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, now Moses wrote Genesis, right?
Actually, in my book, The Weapon, the Globalist Fear, I'm giving archaeological evidence that Moses did compile Genesis, but that he had at his fingertips a series of tablets that were written by eyewitnesses at the successive time of the events that are recorded, so that the record was made very close to the events and then handed down from father to son until Moses compiled them into one book.
Okay, but my point is this. How did Moses know that the earth was without form?
Well, Moses had the tablets in front of him, and the first two tablets were written by Adam because they actually have his signature on the bottom of them.
Well, how did Adam know that?
He could only have been told by his creator. And
my God,
he does record that his creator spoke to him.
Right, that's my whole point. You know, somebody had to tell him.
Somebody had to tell him that part because he wasn't alive when it happened.
Exactly. And my money is on God.
That's good money. You might be right. You're going to collect on that one.
My money's on God. Exactly.
All right. Hey, thanks. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take more phone calls with Jonathan Gray, our final segment here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about two of his works, Dead Men's Secrets, and the weapon the globalists fear, and of course that we reviewed, has to do with the formation of the planet and how it was done. Jonathan is convinced it was done by divine intervention. Jonathan, do you have an email you want to give out at all? Do you want people to write you?
Oh, that would be nice, yes. info@archaeologyanswers.com. But I always have to spell archaeology, George, because it's a difficult word. A for America, R for Rabbit, C for Charlie, H for Hannibal, A for America, E for Elephant, O for Orange. Now, the rest of it comes easy. Archaeology Answers.
Yeah, you got to get that AE in there. That's the tough part. We'll be back in a moment. Final calls next. And on our next Coast to Coast program, Sir Charles Schulz joins us, a fossil hunter's guide to Mars. So get ready for that one when we come back tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan, tell me about the story in the India-Pakistan area of a man turned to glass. What happened there? You remember that one?
Oh, well, yes. That happened over in India in the 1800s. The gentleman was exploring in the northeastern forests, and his foot gave way into a hole below him, and He made a larger aperture, and he pushed his way down, and he found himself in a room. But all the whole room had turned to glass. Sitting there on a chair appeared to be a statue made of glass. And the gentleman looked, but inside that statue he could see internal.
Oh, organs, everything.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Obviously, this whole person was now glass. And there's only one thing can do that, and that's atomic energy.
Wow. Something happened there.
Yeah. And it's interesting that this area, of course, is part of a story in one of the old Indian documents that speaks of nations at war with each other, that where one missile struck a city and destroyed it straight out.
Didn't they find some radioactive skeletons in Pakistan?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
In the ruins of Mohenjo-Daro in the Indus Valley area, there is a square that has been unearthed, a city square. The buildings around the square have evidence of having been melted from radiated heat from above, and there are quite a number of skeletons there that have been found to be radioactive. In one particular human interest case, it looked like a woman and a man holding hands with a child, and they didn't get out in time.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Mason City, Iowa, Justin's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Justin, go ahead.
Hi, I got really a comment and then a question.
Sure.
My comment is I'm really glad to hear as a Christian that there's been scientific proof that the Earth was created. And my question to you is, George, a couple of years ago, I believe it was Timothy Geithner, I can't be for sure, but someone in Washington was talking about a one-world justice system. And then I start thinking about the New World Order. I was just wondering, in your opinion, how long do you think we are away from the New World Order? Well,
I think we're right in it. And that was Zygmunt Brzezinski who was talking about that. And one of the things he was mentioning was that how all of us were becoming aware of what they wanted to do. But I would say within 5 years, we'll see even more dramatic pushes to get this thing done. They're moving pretty darn fast now.
Yeah, they sure are. I spoke to a friend as around about, I think it was 1990, and mentioning the New World Order, and he was incredulous. He said, "Oh, you're making that up." He hadn't heard of it, but everybody, I think, is hearing about it now. It's a reality.
Absolutely. Let's go to Amber, Tri-Cities in the state of Washington, first-time caller. Hello, Amber. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering about the correlation of the pyramids, the Aztec temples, the Stonehenge, and other temples, compared to where they may have been before the continental divide, and the alignment with the Bermuda Triangle. What do you guys kind of thought about that?
All right. Jonathan, first of all, the similarities of all these pyramids.
Yeah, it's very interesting. At certain times in history, we have certain building styles. Today, we've got the 21st century building style, with skyscrapers and so on, and shop fronts and whatever. And worldwide, that's more or less taken on. In the 1800s, you wouldn't see that. So it does change. Each period has its own characteristics. And the pyramids of Egypt, the pyramids of China, the pyramids on Tahiti, in Australia, in the Americas, all have similarities which suggest they were all constructed in the same general period of time. Although there have been out-of-place periods in which pyramid construction has been made. I know they built one in Las Vegas, didn't they?
It's called the Luxor.
That's right. Yes. The general period was consistent with probably the period round about 2150 through to about 1800 BC, more or less, and that would include the original pyramids in Mexico, some of which were predecessors of the ones that followed.
Tell me about this mystery satellite orbiting the poles. What do we know about this?
Oh, the Black Knight.
Yeah.
Yes. That actually was tracked by quite a number of scientists, and still is by some.
Who put it up there?
Well, when America put up her first satellite and the Russians put up theirs, back in October 1957, I think Sputnik 1 went up.
Mm-hmm.
And just a few months later, America had hers in orbit. These were only a few hundred miles above the Earth. But then with excitement, almost with unbelief, millions of people who were scanning this heard a report that French astronomer Jacques Vallée of the Paris Observatory had seen another satellite three times, and he got 11 data points in 45 seconds. It was orbiting in reverse, actually, at an altitude of about 22,000 miles above the Earth, very different from our few hundred miles. And so the question was, how did it get there?
How did it get there, and where did it come from?
Yeah. Now, if we go back to the ancient writings, we notice the Babylonians spoke of satellites orbiting the Earth. Others spoke of spacecraft going to the moon and to the planets of the solar system. So it appears there was a technology capable of doing it just a few thousand years ago, George. And my bet is that's probably from that time. But it hasn't come crashing down to Earth like some of ours do.
Strange.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I assume we still know it's up there.
Apparently, yes. The latest reports are that it's still there. The report I had latest was about a year ago.
Name of our first satellite was the Explorer 1, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Let's go to Sebastopol, California. Marshall, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good.
Thank you for the show tonight. It's really good. I've been wanting to call in for the last couple of weeks. You've had a number of good shows. Tonight is exceptionally well, and I want to talk about something you hit on earlier with you asked the question of where is Noah's Ark? And I've run across some information in the last few years, not directly about Noah's Ark, but actually looking for Noah's tomb and his son's tombs and things like that. I ran across the work of Dr. Bill Shea, and I was wondering if Jonathan had ever heard of him or heard of his work.
Oh, yes. I've communicated with Dr. Bill Shea on a couple of occasions. He's a very thorough investigator, and he was of the opinion that it landed in a similar area to where we sent our expeditions.
Right. There is the site that was researched by Ron Wyatt, and then there is the site that is in actually Armenia, which is the site that he proposes. But what he found in his the article that I ran across with him, he was actually tracing back the sites of the sons, Japheth, Ham, Shem, and Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and they said they found their tomb sites, and I emailed him and I asked him for any other further research, and he sent me he had done three expeditions and he sent me information about that, and I've posted those online at on legendarytimes.com in their forum section, and so if anybody wants to read that, they can go do that. He also has a book that's available that goes into more depth about that. So I was wondering if you'd read any of that.
No, I haven't, but I'd be very interested in you emailing me if you go to my website and sending me some information. That'd be fascinating.
Okay, very good. Let's go to Harlingen, Texas. Glenn's with us, east of the Rockies. Hey, Glenn, thanks for calling.
Hey, George, Jonathan, how you doing?
Good.
Pretty well, Glenn.
Say, I was wondering, I have a question. If you know where chickens come from.
Oh, the old mystery of the chicken and the egg, eh?
No. Oh. Where we all know pronghorn antelope come from the west of America. I was just wondering if you know where chickens come from.
Oh, chickens. Oh, what part of the world you mean?
Right.
Yes. I believe the first example of chickens is in eastern Turkey, which is not a surprise, because if this is where the ark landed, the surviving representative animal life would, of course, be familiar to the people there.
Jonathan, chickens come from the jungles of Southeast Asia, where there still are.
And they're still there, yes, that's true. That's where they are today, and there are also fossils of them over there as well.
George, I'd like to address you for a moment.
Sure.
Every time you've asked your guest how old man is, how old the earth is, he's sidestepped and obfuscated and droned on about how the geological record is wrong. So what he's saying is it's not old. It's 6,000 years old.
No, I don't think he would say that, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, Jonathan.
Go ahead, questioner.
Yeah, I mean, are you a believer in the sixth? No, you can't be.
I'm a believer that our millions of years theory is totally wrong, because the evidence is the strata was laid down rapidly, not from a whole series of ages, but from particularly key event, catastrophically.
So you do believe we're only 6,000 years old?
I believe that the evidence does not show anything that we're much older.
Huh. Well, I thought earlier you said that mankind could be millions of years old.
He's in the strata that evolutionists say is hundreds of millions of years. That's correct. But man is in all that strata, so he could not have arose. If the evidence goes for us, he could not have suddenly appeared in the last form of strata, like we're told by the evolution theory, because he's found buried in all of these strata, which I believe the evidence is now showing were all laid down pretty much at the same time.
Let's go to Victoria, British Columbia on the international line. Hey, David.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask the Jonathan if he had heard of this young woman. There's a grad student at University of Victoria. It was all over the papers locally. I don't know if this got any play internationally. Your name's Genevieve von Petzinger. Anyway, she has come up with 26 letters from cave paintings that they are acquiescing that her research shows that there was a language that was in use for 20,000 years, that she's pulled the language out of these French cave paintings. That people were all aghast, oh, beautiful picture, but they didn't notice all these little symbols around, and she used computers to organize these symbols found throughout these cave paintings for 20,000 years, and it turns out it's a language.
Hmm.
Well, I would go along with the fact that the lettering corresponds with our other discoveries that the cave people had a sophisticated beginning and not a primitive one.
Next up, we'll take a couple more calls, and then that is it. DJ in Syracuse, New York. Go ahead, DJ.
Yes, good evening.
Hey.
Great honor to speak to you, Mr. Gray. I believe men like you and Cremo and Hancock are spot on, and I encourage you. I wish you'd address really the issue, the broader issue, the battle between science and the sacred, and that is essential. And Jung was onto it, and Tolstoy, great thinkers, were onto it ever since the Enlightenment. And that's what you represent, sir. And Heinrich Schliemann, a great man, a forgotten man in your field.
Well, there you go, Jonathan.
Thank you for your kind words. I believe that science, so falsely so-called today, I mean, there's a science we're being taught which is posing as true science, but it's not science based upon evidence, but upon philosophy.
Next up, we go to Bergenfield, New Jersey. Reagan is with us. Hey, Reagan, go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. I was watching a Jack Vanipi program. It's a religious program on cable. And he said that, that at the Bilderberg meeting in Virginia, they said that they put a mandate out that they want everybody implanted with that microchip by like 2014 or 2017. Have you heard anything about that?
I have not.
No, I haven't specifically.
Okay, well, I wanted Jack Vanipi mentioned. I don't know if you've heard of him, Jack Vanipi.
Vanipi? Yeah.
Yeah. That's my question. Thank you, gentlemen. Good
okay.
Night.
Sure thing. Next up, we go to Atlanta, Georgia. Christian, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, George, Mr. Gray.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hello.
I have a quick question about the biblical story about the confusing of the languages in, I guess, around Samaria. You were talking about a lot of different technology and stuff around the world. I also had, you know, seen things in passing about, you know, like landing strips in South America and the transfer of, you know, Egyptian sciences and architecture and mathematics throughout the world. My question is, you know, at that point in time, do you think the language or something broader between people, as far as like a lack of communication from, one part of the world to another, may have a huge, play or start in why a lot of this technology is kind of like gone from, you know, our society or our civilization, or it may have just been like a whole nother stage or age of civilization. Could you kind of explain that?
There's evidence of one language at one time spoken over the world, and we have evidence of this from Australia, from Yemen, from Israel, from the United States, and from China, and that there was an event which quickly dispersed the people who spoke this language. Apparently, the maps that were drawn in the early times were drawn by people who had a common language globally and mapped it. Mapped the whole world. And then after that, there was a confusion of languages.
You know what fascinates me, Jonathan, about the Bible, for example, in the book of Genesis? The stories in there are all based on some kind of fact. Fascinating.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. As an archaeologist, I can't disagree with you.
Let's see if we can get one more in. Scotty in Washington, west of the Rockies. Just got about 30 seconds for you, Scotty. Go ahead.
Okay, Dr. Gray, I was just wondering if you ever encountered any of those gold artifacts in South America that resemble jet aircraft.
Not personally, but I know they exist. I have pictures of them, and I've corresponded with somebody who has handled them.
And what else can they be, Jonathan, but replicas of aircraft?
They have to be of aircraft, yes. And some have been found in Egypt, some other models as well.
The name of the books, Dead Men's Secrets, The Weapon of the Globalist Fear by Jonathan Gray, his website, beforeus.com. Jonathan, thanks for being on the program. Appreciate it.
Right, and a privilege, George.
All right, my friend, you take care. Great archaeologist, great researcher, and just opens up our minds, doesn't he? For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Pundit and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.